Well, good afternoon to everybody. If you would please turn to Matthew chapter 14, I would like to read a story with you because there's an important principle I'd like to glean from it that's important to the sermon. Matthew 14, and let's start in verse 14. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them and healed their sick. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, "This is a deserted place. The hour is late. Send the multitudes away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves some food." But Jesus said to them, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "We have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. He said, "Bring them here to me." Then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass, and he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. He looked up to heaven. He blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitudes. So they all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments that remained. Now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. The principle is this, that out of little comes much, because God's hand is in it. 5 loaves, that's little. Fed 5,000, that's much. Out of little comes much, because God's hand is in it. This is also true with a little book, a small book in the Bible that I would like to go through today. It only has 5 chapters. It's tiny when you consider so many other books in the Bible that have so many chapters in it. So if you please turn to 1 John. 1 John. John is writing to the church, and what he's writing about are anchors. Anchors that he's giving to the church. There are 5 anchors. There are 5 chapters. And the focus is going to be on verse 3 of every chapter, because that's where we find the anchors. Anchors are for our stability. Anchors keep you in place and me in place when all around you and me, things are out of place. What we do know about the writing of the book or this letter is that it was most likely written from Ephesus. The letters were not dated, but the best guess, or most would agree, and really I leaned on what the church has said in some of its writings regarding 1 John, that it most likely was written in the late 90s A.D., John himself was in his late 90s when he wrote this. The last living apostle who had outlived all the other apostles by about 30 years. And if you notice, we begin in verse 1, there's no greeting and there's no hello. And it's because of the importance of the things that have to be said and what will be given to the church. Anchors. Anchors are for our Christian lives. Anchors keep us from drifting. Anchors keep us centered. Anchors keep us firmly in place. John begins in 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. He begins by saying, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and our hands have handled concerning the word of life." He's talking about Jesus Christ. The impact of being around and with Jesus Christ is still fresh in his mind, even though the events he's thinking about happened more than 60 years ago. John, as well as the other disciples, they spent countless hours with Jesus Christ. How many miles do you think they walked together? and all the cities that they went to. All the time they spent traveling by boat. They ate together. They spent so much time together. And time together builds relationships, deep, bonded, close relationships. Notice what Christ said to them. If you can just hold your finger here in 1 John, we'll come right back to it. John chapter 15. John 15, he said to the disciples in verse 14, "You are my friends." He meant that. He spent so much time with these young men. And he said, "You're my friends if you do what I command you." And in verse 13, Jesus said to them, "Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." John was an eyewitness to that. John was the one that with Peter took to the garden. Maybe the disciples he was closest to, so that he could lean on them, because he knew what he was about to go through. And he brought John and Peter and Andrew with him. Back to 1 John. "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled." Do you think that Jesus Christ ever wrestled with the disciples? I wrestled with my brother. I wrestled with my friends in the neighborhood when I was younger. When you spend a lot of time with someone, when you're bonded with someone, and when you're that kind of friend, do you think that Christ ever wrestled, maybe to blow off some steam, or maybe because they were just men and they were human beings? And there are times that we just do that. Or do you think Jesus Christ was detached? And he said, "Don't touch me. I'm not going to wrestle with you. You guys are horsing around. I'm the Son of God. I don't do things like that." Jesus Christ was a human being. And he loved the disciples. Do you think that Jesus Christ ever swam with them? You know, that climate in that area of the world, it's hot. Many of the disciples were fishermen. A lot of Christ's ministry was around water. Do you think on a really, really hot day, when the disciples just wanted to go for a swim to cool off, do you think Jesus Christ went with them? And this John, who wrote this book, was one of the sons of thunder. He had an outgoing personality, a bold disciple, just like Peter was. Do you think ever that they said to Christ, maybe John, maybe Peter, maybe one of the other disciples when they're in the water, to challenge Jesus Christ to a race? "Let's race to the boat." Do you think they ever did that? Because of the friendship they had with one another. Do you think Christ would say, "No way, I just don't do things like that with you humans"? He loved them. And they loved him. How many times do you think they would have done that? To race to the boat. And do you think at times maybe John, maybe Peter, maybe some of the other disciples, as they were racing, maybe somebody reached out and grabbed Christ's ankle because he was winning. Or maybe a disciple that was swimming neck and neck with Christ grabbed Christ's arm to slow him down. He says here, "Our hands have handled." Or is this just a reference to after the resurrection, where Christ showed them his wounds? John had a relationship with Jesus Christ. He had a bond. This one-on-one contact with the very Son of God left an impression on him. And it leads him to bring us to the very first anchor. We'll read about that in just 1 second in verse 3. But let's read verse 2 first. He says, that life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you that eternal life, which was with the Father, was manifested to us. I've seen Jesus Christ, is what he's saying. I spent time with him, and we loved each other. We were bonded. We were friends. And he says in verse 3, that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you that you also may have fellowship with us. That's the first anchor. And it's the anchor of fellowship. This is not a handshake and saying hello. He's talking about a relationship. Strong's, and this is just, you know, when I look up some of these words, I use two sources. I use Strong's and I use Thayer's lexicon of definitions. Because I find, this is just my personal opinion, that Strong's is quite cut and dry with words. It's kind of a skeleton. Strong's defines this word fellowship as partnership. But Thayer's lexicon puts flesh on that. It says contact, intimacy. There is nothing sexual about the intimacy that John is talking about. What John is saying is, I want us to have a close, intimate family relationship with one another. We just look across the page how he's addressing baptized adults in the church. In chapter 2, verse 1, John says, my little children. He says, my little children, these things I write to you. He repeats that phrase 9 times in the book. He's not looking down on anybody in the church. He's not being demeaning in any way. But you can see that what's in his mind, what he's conveying, that it's about a relationship that he wants to have with God's people. And that God's people have to have with him, which mimics the relationship that he had with Jesus Christ and all the other disciples. He sincerely cares for the welfare of God's people, and that's why in this book he gives us anchors to keep us stable, to keep us secure. Hold your finger here, we're going to come right back, but there's something that we can see in the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1. In Ruth chapter 1, beginning in verse 14, we read that they lifted up their voices and wept again. This is Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth. They're going through a terrible time. 3 widows. Is what we have. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And Naomi said to her, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. There's nothing for you here, Ruth. I'm a widow. You're a widow. There's nothing here. Go back. Just go back to where you came from. Maybe you'll find something, but you're not going to find anything here. But look what Ruth says to her. But Ruth said in verse 16, she says, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. That's fellowship. That's the kind of fellowship that John is talking about. That's the kind of anchor that it is. There is something else that John says in verse 3. It's hard to believe, it's hard to take in, but it's true. He says, and truly, in the second half of the verse, and truly, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. That same intimacy, that same family bond, that same friendship that we are to have with one another, we are to have with God the Father and with Jesus Christ. Fellowship with God means that we agree with Him. Do you remember Mr. Armstrong? So often when he would give a sermon, that he always would quote Amos 3:3, which says, "How can two walk together unless they be agreed?" How can we ever have fellowship with God if we don't agree with everything that God says? It's impossible. Fellowship with God means that we walk, that we live, and that we think according to His word. Otherwise, how can we have fellowship with God? We can't. If God is walking in one direction and you or I walk in the opposite, there's no fellowship there. This is what John says in verse 6 of chapter 1. If we say that we have fellowship with Him, if we're saying that we're walking with God, if we have that kind of a relationship with Him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. You can't be living like the world does in spiritual darkness and have fellowship with God and Christ. But if we walk in the light, John says, as He is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. If I agree with God and you agree with God, if I with all my might and strength and soul try to do everything that God says and you do the same, we're going to have fellowship with one another because we're all going to be on the same page, and that page is God's page. It's the page John was on. And his desire was to be on the same page with God's people. And he's pointing out this anchor that's so important, this anchor of fellowship. Philippians, if you could hold your hand in 1 John, we'll come right back to it. Philippians chapter 2. In verse 1, Paul says, "Therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, if there is any comfort of love, if there's any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded." We need to be on the same page, God's page. Having the same love, he says, being of one accord and of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. That's fellowship, isn't it? Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. He gave his life for his friends. We're his friends. He says that in John 15. And if we consider what really is the heart of fellowship, or what it's framed in, is love. And that is another anchor that we'll visit a little later when we get to chapter 5. Anchor number 2, chapter 2, verse 3. John says, "Now by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments." The commandments, God's law, it's an anchor. And it is the very anchor that, quote unquote, Christianity puts in a nice little package and they call it the Old Covenant, and then conveniently nail it to the cross. They remove this important anchor. Without an anchor, you don't have stability. Verse 3, he says, "Now by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. He," in verse 4, "who says, 'I know him,' and does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him." The commandments are guardrails for life. The commandments are there to keep us on our right path. This is what David says. And you know how much this anchor meant to David. He lived by it. He meditated on it day and night. And he loved God's law. He loved the commandments. This is what he says in Psalm 119. 119 in verse 105. He says, "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." It's not just a right path. It's a lighted path to clearly see the behaviors, the situations that you need to stay out of. Because in the end, they just cause harm. To follow in the wrong footsteps is to sin. The wages of sin is death. It's a serious matter. The commandments are extremely important. He says in verse 97 of Psalm 119, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. You, through the commandments, make me wiser than my enemies. For they are ever with me, and I have more understanding than all my teachers. For your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients because I keep your precepts. I restrain my feet from every evil way that I may keep your word." It's an anchor in his life. And the times when he went off the rails is when he dropped the anchor. And boy, did his life change because of it. The terrible situation that ended up happening because of Bathsheba. Because he let this anchor go for a time. In verse 102, he says, "I have not departed from your judgments, for you yourself have taught me. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through your precepts I get understanding, and therefore I hate every false way." Because he could see, if you go a false way, the terrible, awful consequences that do come. He tasted some of that himself when he dropped the anchor. There's another thing that the commandments do. They nurture and protect relationships. If we think about the Ten Commandments, the first four are there to nurture and to protect our relationship with God. They are very simple, basic first steps. The first commandment says that you are to have no other gods before me. What God is saying is that there is nothing, no one, nothing is to come between you and me. That is how serious God is about having a relationship with his people. To having an unbreakable bond, a love, an attachment that you just can't have if it's full of other things, if other things are in the way. And so God says, have nothing in between us. Nothing. Second commandment, he says, you don't make anything or serve anything that takes the place of me. Because if something does, an idol, a painting, a picture, a hobby, it's not God. The Catholics have statues that they pray to and they serve. That's not God. They don't have fellowship with God because they're breaking his commandments. They're not walking according to the way he says to walk. They can't have fellowship if they're praying to a statue or a medal or a picture. Third commandment, we're not to take God's name in vain. It's about respecting and honoring God's name. It doesn't matter what God is doing or how busy he is with all the things that come to his attention. When you mention his name, he hears you. He looks and he pays attention because he loves his people. And if certain words are going to come out of my mouth, if I'm cursing and then using God's name in that curse, I'm not respecting or honoring my God, am I? It's going to damage the relationship because I'm cheapening who God is by being so careless with the words that come out of my mouth. What about the Sabbath? You know the demands and the entanglements and the encroachments that our jobs have on our lives? I get calls at home. I get calls on my cell phone. There's pressures. There's problems. Our jobs are consuming. And God created the Sabbath as a pause button. He created the Sabbath so we can freeze all the pulls on you and me. All those demands. As the sun begins to set on Friday, you close out all those things. Because what the Sabbath gives us back is time. Time to rest. Time to relax. Time to recharge. And it gives you and I time to spend a little more of it with our family. That's an important relationship. It gives us more time here to fellowship, which is an anchor. And it gives us more time to spend with God. These first four commandments, don't they nurture and protect that? Between you and God and between me and God. What about the next six? The fifth commandment is to honor your father and your mother. When we get married, we are to leave our father and our mother and to cleave to our mate. So why is this here? Why is that fifth commandment so important? Because it's important to keep and nurture that relationship with your mom and dad, no matter how old you are. Fellowship is an anchor. The commandments are an anchor. They're tied together. And they're to keep us on the straight and narrow, to keep us balanced. The sixth commandment is self-evident, isn't it? You shall not kill. It's not about taking a life, but preserving it. Seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. That is to protect marriage. This commandment is a wall around your marriage. There's no windows to this wall. There's no doors to this wall. No one is to get in. It's to protect that beautiful thing that God created, that one man and one woman can have with each other, and it's called marriage. The eighth and ninth commandment, they're related. And it's interesting that they're right next to each other. You know what stealing is? Lying about what belongs to you. It's lying about how you got it. It's lying about the property that's in your possession. Stealing is a falsehood. Because you have taken something that's not yours and you're pretending to own it. You're acting like it's yours and it's not. Can you have fellowship with a robber? No, you can't. The ninth commandment, we're not to lie. I had a salesman come visit me this week. I don't like this guy. I don't do business with him. And I don't have a friendship, not even a casual one with him, because he lies through his teeth. And I don't like him. I have a zero business relationship with him. Not even a casual friendship. What can you build with someone who lies in fellowship? Nothing. You don't know what's straight or what's right with what that person is saying. You can't build a friendship or even have one in the dark. You can't build a friendship on falsehoods either. What about the 10th commandment? Not to covet. If an individual is so bent, so consumed over what someone else has that they're coveting it, how can there be fellowship? Because that person is all about the get, not about the give. Because a friendship and fellowship, it's tied to the give, not the get. This is what John says. If we go back to 1 John chapter 3. In verse 24, John says, "Now he who keeps his commandments abides in him." There's a relationship there. Something that's being preserved. Something that's being enhanced. A tremendous connection, a bond. "He who keeps his commandments abides in him, and he in him." It's a beautiful verse. Anchor number 3. 1 John 3, let's begin in verse 2. "Beloved," do you notice how he's addressing the baptized members of the church? With such kindness and sincerity. "Beloved," a very endearing term. "Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." And here's the anchor in verse 3. "And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure." Anchor number 3 is hope. You know, there are times that we use hope as like a futile last chance. Have you ever said to somebody, "Well, I hope it works out"? Because what you really know in your heart of hearts is that there's no real expectation that it'll work out. So you might say something like, "I hope it works out." That's not hope. Last week, Klay Thompson, who is a basketball player for the Golden State Warriors after they had swept the San Antonio Spurs, was asked by a reporter about Steph Curry's return. Steph Curry had injured his knee. And the reporter asked Klay, he said, "Do you think that Steph is going to come back and be able to play in the second round of the playoffs?" And Klay Thompson said this, "Well, I hope so, but I'm not expecting it." That's not hope. Hope is defined as a confident expectation that a desire will be fulfilled. John is saying here that we of all people on the face of this earth have every reason to have hope. He says in verse 2, "We know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him. We shall see him as he is." Do you know that the holy days have hope for us? Isn't he talking about the Day of Trumpets here? What is our hope regarding the resurrection? Or if we're still alive when Christ returns, that we will be changed in the twinkling of an eye. Is it the kind of hope that Klay Thompson expressed? "Well, I hope so. I hope I'll be in the resurrection. Overcoming's hard. Life is tough." Or is it a confident expectation that a desire will be fulfilled? There is no lack of confidence in John when he writes this. He says, "We shall see him as he is." What about our confident expectation of the hope that we have for our children? The Feast of Tabernacles points to us and what they can have. I want to read to you something from Isaiah. I always think about the wonderful world tomorrow, the millennium. and the confident expectation that my kids will live here with your kids. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth children for trouble, for they shall be the descendants of the blessed of the Eternal, and their offspring with them. That's our grandkids. Not living in this world, but living in the world to come. It shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer, God says. While they are still speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox. And dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Eternal. A confident expectation that a desire will be fulfilled that God has given to us as parents. What about the last great day? What about the hope of living with the relatives we never knew because they will live again? I had a really good relationship with my great-grandmother. My great-grandfather died in 1955. I never knew him. My great-grandma really didn't talk too much about my great-grandfather. My great-grandmother had 6 kids, 5 girls and a boy. I had the opportunity to know all my great-aunts, but not my great-uncle. He was killed in 1944 at 23. When the Germans came into Italy, because my great uncle could speak German, they used him as an interpreter. And they treated him well because of it. But unfortunately, the Italian underground considered him an enemy. And one day, this happened in 1944 when he was visiting his girlfriend. There was a knock on the door, and the partigiani, who are the Italian underground, took my great-uncle and they killed him, accusing him of collaborating with the Nazis. He was just trying to save his life to be an interpreter. I mean, he was in a bad spot. If he refuses to help the Germans in interpreting, they would kill him, then his own people killed him. The last great day is hope for you and me, for the relatives we've never known. They're going to come up, and you and I are going to have the opportunity to eat with them, spend time with them, and give them hope. The very anchor that John talks about in chapter 3, because they will then understand the purpose to their life. And you and I will show them these anchors that John is giving us. The anchor of fellowship, the anchor of the commandments, and the anchor of hope. It's a beautiful thing, what John is saying in this little book that gives us much. We go through the holy days year by year, and what they should be doing is renewing and refreshing hope. But hope is not just for the future. Hope is also for the present. In verse 22 of 1 John 3, John says this: whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. Do you have hope in this? In other words, do you have the confidence, the assurance, and the optimism that what you ask, you will receive? What do we read in Hebrews 6, verse 19? Paul says, this hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast. Anchor number 4. This anchor is spread out over several verses. And the anchor that John gives us in chapter 4 has several components to it. This anchor sounds an alarm, a warning. And the reason is because the church of God has suffered greatly all through its history because of wolves. Acts 20. We'll come right back to chapter 4 here, but if we can just take a peek here at Acts 20. This is what Paul says in verse 29 of Acts 20. For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. I happened to see a video this week of a shepherd who had one wolf come through his flock, and they videoed what that one wolf did. They captured the wolf. It was a scrawny animal, but it devastated the flock. You know, as I was looking at that video, as this shepherd was videoing, it just makes no sense what that wolf did. He killed about 12 sheep. He didn't eat any of them. And some of them were lying right next to each other, 4 or 5 of them, and then there would be another little patch, another 4 or 5. And then there were the other sheep. They were all scattered. Some of them had been bitten in the neck. They had blood all over their necks. Others had been attacked from the back. They were wounded pretty severely. I don't know if those sheep would have survived. I don't know what that shepherd did. But you know, that's exactly what happened in worldwide. When wolves came in, and they severed all the anchors by saying eventually that those commandments, they're done away. It's old covenant. It affected fellowship. Families were torn apart. Friendships were severed. What happened to hope? A lot of damage was caused because of wolves. 2 Timothy. Second Timothy chapter 2, beginning in verse 16. Shun profane and idle babblings, for they will increase to more ungodliness, and their message will spread like cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort, who have strayed concerning the truth, saying that the resurrection is already past, and they overthrow the faith of some. The faith of some. In other words, their hope for what the Day of Trumpets would mean and does mean. That teaching and that lie destroyed the anchor of hope in some. Paul, Peter, Jude, and John all warned about the problems of false teachers and apostasy. 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 2. Peter begins in verse 1 by saying, but there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you. Wolves, not sparing the flock, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And it says many will follow their destructive ways. That's what happened in worldwide, isn't it? Many were affected, not just some, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. That's why John writes about this important anchor in chapter 4 of 1 John. He says in verse 1, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. But this you know, the Spirit of God, every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God, and every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world." This is the anchor called testing. It's very interesting what he's done here. In verse 1, he uses the word test. In verse 2 and 3, he uses the word confess. You know, the word confession in Thayer's lexicon of definitions means to profess. In other words, what is said. What is being said? In another entry in Thayer's lexicon of definitions for the word confession is to say the same thing as another. In other words, continuity. Is there continuity in what is being said when the wolf speaks? A test, which he uses in verse 1, means to examine, to prove, to scrutinize. This anchor is telling us that there are times that we will have to test the confession. In other words, test what is being said. And we test by a standard. The standard is the Word of God. And we test to see if what is being said, if there's continuity in the teaching, the continuity in what is being said. I think that it can be easily illustrated with the Sabbath. Throughout the history of the church, the Sabbath is a marker. If you want to trace the Church of God through history, you use the Sabbath as a marker. The church has always taught the importance of keeping the Sabbath. We were in worldwide, we kept the Sabbath. We were taught to keep the Sabbath. There was a Sabbath booklet. But after Mr. Armstrong died, the wolves came in and things began to change. Eventually, everything did. I want to read to you a confession. In other words, the teaching. In other words, what is being said, is said, and has been said regarding the Sabbath by the church we used to attend. And I quote, "All the Sabbatarian arguments are false. We cannot prove that the Sabbath existed or was commanded before Moses. We cannot prove that it is valid because it is part of the Ten Commandments. We cannot prove that it is important for Christians simply because it was important for ancient Israel. We cannot prove that Jesus commanded it or that Paul commanded it. Instead, we see that Jesus argued for liberty." End quote. That's not a continuity of teaching, is it? The church never, ever taught such garbage. But the wolves have no shame to say it. And what happened to the many? They didn't use this anchor. They didn't test the confession. You can use four scriptures. Mark 2:27 through 28, which says, "The Sabbath was made for man." Genesis 2, verse 2, we find that God created the Sabbath after he created man, and he set the day apart. He sanctified it and blessed it, called it the Sabbath. In Exodus 20, we are told, "Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy." And what did Paul say about the commandments? Let's actually see what Paul, 1 Corinthians 7. Verse 19, "Circumcision is nothing, uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters." This anchor is very important. The fifth anchor is love. 1 John 5. Let's start in verse 1. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone who loves him, who begot, also loves him who is begotten of him. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. Love is what builds relationships. Love is action. Love is the glue that binds us with God and binds us with one another. Love applies to all relationships. In 1 John 4, verse 7, John says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God." What are some of the nuts and bolts of what love is? 1 Corinthians 13. Paul says, "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I've become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal." Without love, Paul says, it's just noise. "And though I have the gift of prophecy, if I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith that I could remove mountains, but if I have not love, I'm nothing." Verse 4. Here's the nuts and bolts of love. It's important for fellowship. It's in the commandments. If we love God, we're going to do what he says. It's in that anchor of hope. Because if we love God's way of life, if we love the commandments, and if we love God, we're going to use that anchor to defend and hold on to the truth. Love suffers long and is kind. It doesn't envy, does not parade itself, is not puffed up. It does not behave rudely, it does not seek its own, is not provoked, it thinks no evil. Isn't that the person you want to be bonded with? Isn't this the kind of friend you want to have? Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things. You know, this is how God deals with us and how God treats us. How do we deal and treat each other? Does not rejoice in iniquity, verse 6, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. You know what one of the greatest testing grounds for love is? Marriage. Male and female. In so many ways, we're alike, right? We're born the same. We're made from the ground and the dirt. We have many of the same features, two eyes, two ears, a nose. But we think so differently. We see things differently. We process things differently. And God created such a wonderful thing to put two different people together and call it marriage. How in the world do you make it work? Love. You know, marriage sometimes, it's like two people trying to ride a unicycle. You can't. It doesn't work. Ephesians 5. Paul says in verse 28, husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He says, he who loves his wife loves himself. Do you know that there is no I in love? But there is I in give. It's what I can do. It's what I will do for her. You know, love is not a one-way street. Love is a relationship with substance. Marriage should be more like as another analogy, two people riding a tandem bicycle. You're attached. One person can't go that way and the person with the handlebars goes the other. It's one bike. And you're pedaling together. Love is an anchor for all relationships. The marriage relationship is different from the relationship that you will have with your best friend, with your brother, with your aunt, or with a family here in church. But love is the key. Love is the anchor. 1 John 4, verse 11. Beloved. You see the approach of John to the baptized members of the church. Consistent in his kindness, in his attention, in his love, and his desire to give anchors for the stability of God's people all through the ages. Beloved, he says in verse 11, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has seen God at any time, and if we love one another, God abides in us, and his love has been perfected in us. And by this we know that we abide in him, and he in us, because he has given us of his Spirit. And what you find is then we have fellowship. Fellowship with one another. Fellowship with God the Father. Fellowship with Jesus Christ. We're all on the same page. God's page. The commandments are important. Hope is important. I want to come full circle. I want to go back to Matthew 14 to conclude. I want to go back to that story that we read in the beginning. There's an important principle here. Matthew 14, beginning in verse 14. When Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them, and he healed their sick. When it was evening, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place. The hour is already late. Send the multitudes away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food." But Jesus said to them, "They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat." And they said, "We have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. He said, "Bring them here to me." He commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass. He took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitudes. So they all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of fragments that remained. The principle is that from little comes much, because God's hand is in it. And it's true with 1 John. It's a small book, a little book, just 5 chapters. But we've been given much. You notice that at the end of verse 20, that out of the fragments, 12 full baskets were collected. Did you know that there are 24 books in the Bible that contain 5 chapters or less? really small books, little books. They give us much. Take the time to go through them. Take the time to go through them. Because out of little comes much. Because God's hand is in it.